Welcome to Unpacking the Digital Shelf, where we explore brand manufacturing in the digital age. Hello, Digital Shelf listeners. Peter Crosby, Executive Director of the Digital Shelf Institute here. Social commerce, the latest daunting buzzword for many brands. What's the best way to test and scale these new channels to prove out what works for your brand, for your audience? Luke Garrow, EVP and Content Director at marketing agency GYK Antler, knows the answers and shared them with Rob Gonzalez and me. So Luke, you are a social media, social commerce, digital marketing expert. When was the last time you actually bought something you found on Instagram?
That's a great question. So the last thing I bought was this product called Ink, the original. It's a tattoo kind of moisturizer slash reinvigoration slash stuff that just makes your tattoos pop again. So I have several tattoos, all going on 20 years old, and I love the beach. So I got hit with an ad on Instagram, and what I tend to do when I get hit with ads is figure out why me? How did this come to me? And I don't talk about tattoos. But what I did realize is a few months before that, I had posted a photo of a tattoo that has my mom's name on it for Mother's Day. Yes, I am that child.
That's so sweet.
And whether they actually did this or not, I wanted to give them credit for somehow they had photo recognition that maybe could see tattoos. I don't know if that's what happened, but I want to think in my fantasy world that people can hyper-target us, that that may be a reality of how they found
it. And so some people might say fantasy world. Others would say that's super creepy and I wish they wouldn't. So you seem to – is it because of your business that you fall in the into the – wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, and I certainly get my fair share of ads that I wish would not show up in my feed. This happened to be one where in a few weeks I was about to go to the beach and I was like, you know what? I'm going to give it a shot. And I ordered it right there and got it. And I've been using it. And I'll tell you in maybe in a few years how the results are. But so far, it's a product that I like. And I it seemed very hyper-focused to me. And I actually
needed it. The rest of your body will look like crap. But those tattoos are going to look sweet.
Yeah, when they bury me, they'll say, guy had some sweet ink.
You know, it's funny. There are this Facebook conspiracy theorists that swear that they're listening to everything that you say. So that even if you're not posting about tattoos, if you talk about tattoos near your phone, that Facebook is targeting you and listening to you somehow. Wired Magazine had an article a few months about it. There's just a whole group of people that just believe that you're being listened to.
I am 24
hours a day now.
I am raising my hand for those of you at home. Well, it does. It's hard for me in some of the cases to trace back, because I totally get that we ought to be able to scan photos and discover it. That makes sense to me. Copy on the website. But it does seem like I've not been on social media. I've been talking about something, and the next thing that happens, it shows up. And Luke's nodding his head. So you think that that's actually happening?
Well, I've had my phone all of a sudden answer questions without me pressing a button on it. Has that ever happened to you where you're speaking and then all of a sudden from your pocket, your phone kind of says something back to you?
That has not happened to me. Are you in therapy? Because I'm not sure that's your phone.
Save that for the next podcast.
So as we move into the realm of how this applies to business besides our personal peccadilloes, as you know, our listeners, our audience are really the people at brand manufacturers think of the people that make stuff, the Legos, the L'Oreals, the 3Ms of the world, all that, sort of trying to figure out how to operate in this new sort of digitally focused world. And when you think about those people, a lot of them are new to building a direct relationship with their end consumer and buyer. And because a lot of them for decades, and in some cases almost centuries, have been going through channels where then their story is retold by the distributors or the retailers that are selling their product. What do you think this sort of crisis and opportunity is today to have that pressure to connect directly with your consumer? How do you guys think about it at GYK Antler?
Well, we see it as both an opportunity and a necessity. You know, the opportunity is you can have a much more rich experience with an audience now than you ever could before. You know, it used to be you could put out a message, you could put out an image, you could put out stuff, people can see it and then come try to discover your product wherever it's for sale. Now you have the opportunity to give them much more information. You have an opportunity to talk to them, you know, through two-way communication channels in real time and address specific needs. You can hyper-target exactly who you want to talk to. So that's where the opportunity is. The necessity is everyone expects that. Everyone wants that. And so you have these startups coming into every industry who are operating very nimbly and quickly, and they're out there talking to people, giving them information, bringing people into their marketing and advertising, you know, bringing people into the conversations, learning from people in real time, giving them opportunities that they're only getting through these channels. So where that opportunity meets that necessity is where it becomes such a strong thing that you kind of have to be doing, and you have to kind of pick and choose where you hone in, you know, the battle you want to fight on that territory. But you kind of have to be there if you're a product that people want to know something about and people are inquiring further than, you know, a message that you send out. That's a one-way thing. If people are ever going to ask you a question or people are ever going to have a comment or something that could benefit a conversation, you kind of have to be there for it.
What's an example of a larger company that's doing this well? Because I think, I mean, to your point, if you're a small, nimble company, the founder wakes up in the morning and they've got their phone on them, and anytime anyone mentions anything about their products, they're on their phone and they're tweeting. I got to imagine, let's pick Casper, for example, mm-hmm. right, which has done an awesome job in social media. In the early days, founder, anytime anyone mentions anything about Casper or mattresses, is responding in near real time. If I think about some of the major brands that I know, they have internal conversations about, well, is a 48-hour SLA on an Amazon comment sufficient or not sufficient? Sure. I mean, so you're going from, you know, real-time phone in your pocket from the founder to some social media person in a corner with a 48-hour SLA, and it's just, it's a world of difference in operating behavior. What's an example of a big company that's doing this well, that's actually engaging at the level that you're implying is useful here?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's different ways I think brands are exemplifying that they're doing it very well. And it depends on what you're actually there to accomplish. And so on one side of the spectrum, you have a brand like Wendy's, who's just there to socialize and make people laugh. Yeah. And they absolutely crush it on a channel like Twitter, because in real time, they are interacting with people. They're interacting with other brands. They're kind of saying whatever they want to say, whether it's about a trending topic or a reaction to what somebody else said. And they're humanizing their brand in a way that a lot of brands might be scared to do or might not know how to do or just don't want to take on the risk of doing that.
And in a way that if you'd asked me 5 years ago, will that be Wendy's brand personality on social? I would have said no. They don't really have a personality at all. They have. I mean, I guess their founder or CEO was was it Dave? I don't remember. Was their personality for a while, but in social, it really has become sort of this snarky, fantastic voice.
Yeah. So you have a brand like that that's just going all in on having a personality and just socializing, being at the level of the audience that they're talking to. Then you have other brands who have gone way deeper into launching complete content platforms, right, that are meant to serve a specific need for an audience even beyond the products or services that they offer. So, you know, it could be Johnson & Johnson has, you know, adopted and took on and grown Baby Center, which is, you can't even tell that it's one of their properties, but it's there to talk to moms. And from what I heard, there's, I think, 7 in 10 expecting parents or current parents are on that platform getting
Baby
information.
Baby Center's incredible.
So you have brands that have gone that far to where they're like, we're actually going to put content and building audience first ahead of our product and services and create a business model around that then feeds, you know, what we do as a core business. So, yeah, there's a lot of good examples like that. And, I mean, there's even age-old ones like that. You know, John Deere has The Furrow, which is a magazine that's gone out to farmers for, I believe, over 100 years now. And that was well before digital or anything. They recognize we got to give people information beyond just how to use our products. We have to give them information that actually serves the need of their lives.
Yeah, so it is not just a consumer, I'm selling to consumer concern or opportunity. It's also there for people that are selling to businesses as mm-hmm. well. Yeah. And when you think about, I need to gather this audience, and then I would like to make these channels work for me as a manufacturer. Some people have taken to call that category social commerce. A, is that a term that resonates for you? And if so, what? How do you define it to a customer for your agency?
So social commerce, I think most purely people define it as when you're directly selling through a platform. I like to look at it a little more broadly than that because I think, yeah, sure, you can directly monitor when somebody clicks and buys on a platform, but that doesn't take into account the influence you possibly have on people buying it elsewhere. It doesn't really take into account the ongoing kind of information and images or other stuff you can give to people to get them to either use your product more or look into the other products you offer. So I look at the world of social commerce being how does social media channels influence people's purchasing habits? So yeah, I think the most direct KPI when it comes to that is somebody using like a shoppable button and actually buying on a platform. But if we can take a barbecue sauce and give people 100 different ways to use it through social media, and they're going to keep paying attention and wanting to adopt those ways, we're going to keep selling barbecue off the shelves. And to me, that's how social commerce is more of like an influential tactic than a direct measurable sale tactic.
How much does that level of investment require like an evangelical executive that just believes in it? Because I think about the Wendy's example as an example, mm-hmm. or like Arby's has a similar approach to the way that they engage the market. They've got somebody there who says, you know what, I don't know exactly how to tie this snarky Wendy's strategy to selling more hamburgers, mm-hmm. but I'm going to do it anyway because I believe that it just increases their awareness, right? So there's an element of investing in education and investing in the audience and investing in the engagement, which isn't directly traceable to a sale other than maybe indirect ways. So how do they actually justify the investment internally? What KPIs for folks that are looking at big picture mm-hmm. that they're using, like the barbecue example, to talk to their management team and talk to their board and say, look, it's worth this investment, even if it's not directly relating to sales?
Yeah, making the business case for it can be simple if you wanted to say, here's the only reason we're using it, or it can be complex if you're combining both these short-term and long-term goals. I always try to steer people to look at the long term of it because you're putting effort and resources into a channel where it's not a one and done play. You're not putting up a billboard for a month. You're not running a TV spot for a few weeks. You are putting stuff out there that is timely and does get looked at there, but in a lot of cases has potential to be seen much later on. It has a chance to kind of take on a life of its own. So you always have to look at the short and long term. I think if somebody was saying, we want to get into social media and content and we need to see in a very short time period results, I would say then you're basically using it as an ad platform. You know, you're running a campaign, you're promoting a product that you need to see move there. And therefore, your approach is going to be short term focused. And, you know, the idea of a KPI of growing an audience isn't on that list because that's a long term play.
Yeah.
The big picture is where I think people need to put their heads. It's looking at all of the different options. And you can definitely interject short-term sales objectives and short-term KPIs that are going to be measured through website clicks and sales and stuff that's very easy to measure. But then you have to look at the more qualitative aspect of, well, what if we deliver value content like Johnson & Johnson or John Deere is doing? And what's the value of an audience for us? And for some brands, it's going as far as, well, we're just going to learn from them and we're going to make better products because we're learning from them. And, you know, we're going to value this audience as a long-term asset that we can, you know, pay to promote new content to. We can learn from them. We can bring them in. Maybe there's some advocates or people that we can turn into voices for our brand within that mix. So it's always a mix of looking at those short and long-term. And for me, you know, the business case is more on that long-term because the value of an audience is a lot less. It's a lot more difficult to put a dollar amount on that than a direct sale, you know?
And if you think about what the, because I think for the short-term campaigns, the KPIs around that are probably pretty definable. But I'm imagining for an executive that's trying to think of how do I think about this as a holistic, integrated, longer campaign for my brand to build this audience, what are the sort of longer-term KPIs that they're tracking on an ongoing basis to judge whether they're achieving their goal?
There's some definitely still related to the end goal of selling. So repeat customers. Are you able to target people, have those people you targeted who are already identified as either part of your audience or a existing customer, can you get them to buy more? So that's kind of the vertical volume, getting people to continue to stay loyal. I think even just, you know, the ways you can use them to grow, whether it's product development or other kind of business functions there, I think looking beyond sales as being the only end goal and looking at other things you could get out of it. And for some brands, it's even like, maybe we have an event series and we want people to show up. Are we increasing event attendance because we grew an audience and we already have people who have self-identified raise their hand as somebody that's a fan or interested in what we're talking about? And is that able to parlay into other things we're doing that are part of our marketing mix?
It's like, if you take the long-term audience building view, it's like moving from social as a media platform where you've got outbound communication only to social as an engagement platform where you're growing repeat viewers who you expect to come back to you, from driving short-term sales in a way that you might, you know, include in your market mix model and how did this impact sales and so on and so forth, to how many people you get to show up for your brand when you need them every once in a while. And that shift in thinking is I think a tough shift in thinking for a lot of people, right? Because the ROI isn't direct. The ROI, what it means for your business this year, is a hard thing to quantify. If you're Wendy's and you just stop tweeting, is that going to hurt your business in the short term? It may not, right? So there is an element here of the folks that are doing it well. It does feel like there's a leap of faith that some of them take to keep investing in it. And am I reading that wrong, or is there really, you know, there's believers and there's kind of non-believers? Mm-hmm.
I think you're absolutely reading it correctly. It's having the audacity to implement a long-term plan, which like sounds funny to say out loud, because of course we should all have long-term plans, right?
Yeah.
When you put yourself into a business function where, you know, people are changing jobs and roles and there's things that are out there in the greater world that are affecting how we do stuff, it's a lot more, it's a lot easier to look at the short term and prove that something worked in a quicker time frame than to say, just trust me, we're going to do this for 3 to 5 years and I guarantee it's going to work. Now, there's ways to see if you're trending towards a longer term goal. But I think it's a little bit more of a risk in a lot of situations to say, let's just blindly go for something for years. So you still have to mix the short term and the long term, because you have to constantly be making a business case for this, that it's working, and you have to be smartly measuring and willing to kind of shift and admit that maybe something didn't quite work like you wanted it to work, and be able to accept that and optimize your efforts going forward from there. But I do agree with you. It takes somebody believing in it and then having that kind of that macro view that believes in it, and then the micro steps that lead to getting there, and having healthy conversations along the way to see if everyone still feels like it's working, and be able to shift on a dime if you need to.
I think what a lot of our brand manufacturers struggle with, I'm sure this is true of all of your clients as well, is the job of creating content. What made me think of it was I was on your website reading some of your blog posts, and you had the benefits of creating social media content in bulk was the blog post. But then I was trying to contrast that with social media feels like an instant and conversational channel. So how should these executives think about their content creation process?
Mm-hmm. So I think there's the strategic side of it. How do you hone it in? Who is the core audience? You're not going to go for everybody. Who's the most relevant audience that you think content's going to resonate best with? And what is the specific thing you can deliver? So rather than talking about a lot of different stuff, what's the one thing you can really be known for? And so from a strategic perspective, I always say find the one thing and go all in on that first. Maybe you can build from there. So that's from a strategic perspective. Then when it comes to creation, you're right. A lot of people have the thought leadership and information and ideas there. It's probably what birthed some of these businesses, right? Is some really smart thinking that led to either the products or services they offer. So how do you extract that and package it up? So if strategically you're honed in on a specific topic or theme that everyone's going to recognize you for and come back to get more about that from you, then how do you go about the right kind of production process? And that's where, you know, the blog post that you're referencing that we put up recently was about batching. It's we found that if you are able to take a step back and get out of the day-to-day, week-to-week, potentially even month-to-month aspect of producing content and think a little more broadly, you can actually produce higher quality content that, you know, really plays into the quality over quantity matter. You know, there's some, you know, types of content where I'd say once a month, maybe you send this thing to your email list or something like that, and you can you know, promote it through social or whatever, but really, really kind of figure out what the right strategic way to hone in and then the right cadence. And don't think you have to go big immediately too. You know, I think there's ways where you can gradually build towards something, but the more you can hone it in, I think it becomes a more tangible model to grasp, because it doesn't seem so daunting that like every time you're sitting down to plan, you're coming up with a million new things. You're focused on what your topic or theme is, and then you're continually executing off there. And that's where the ideas flow, because everybody's got that thing that it needs to point back to, and every idea can ladder right up to that. When you're thinking about content and that approach, and you're going to be the person who is the kind of champion for this, I think that tough decision does have to come in there of who's the core we go to, and then look from there, well, does that appeal to some of the broader audiences? But the more you focus it, the easier it becomes, not just for subject matter and whatnot, but even when it comes to targeting and whatnot. And I think the strategy of who that core audience is should transcend the entire business, from sales all the way through to marketing and content. And then if you're nailing it there and you've figured out your content creation machine and you're doing great, you can always build off of that. But if you try to start broad, you're going to have a lot more of a challenge measuring the results, because you could go in any direction at any time with any person.
And additionally, probably trouble getting creative that actually lands with the person. With, you can't do that for every persona at once, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. I mean, make up the most specific audience in the world. If you're like, I want to talk to left-handed people in Milwaukee who have cats, and I don't know why you'd ever want to do that, but if you wanted to do that, that kind of makes it easier to figure out how to talk to them, right? You know, you've already kind of narrowed in certain things about them that are specific to them, and you all know, you're all watching news or paying attention to brands on social media. If somebody literally had a headline or opening paragraph to an article or something that directly addressed you, you're hooked. Well, you're in on that.
That's the advantage that some of the upstart brands have that the big ones don't have. Is that when you're small and you're just launching, you can focus on a niche audience and you can be hyper-specific to who they are. And there's tons of examples that are out there that are like that. So whether in the coffee space, for example, I think in store there's 8 brands of coffee on average that you can pick from. In a grocery store and online, it's like in the 30s of mm-hmm. brands that you can pick from. It's just it's a crazy explosion. And the coffee brands depend on whether you care about fair trade, whether you care about organic, whether you care about high grown, whether you care about fruit flavors, all this type of stuff. And each one of those brands has its own audience that they can actually talk to. You know, people that live in the coastal cities, people that live in country. I mean, they've sort of carved out the market in different ways. But if you're Folgers, mm-hmm. right, you've been mass market. You might have started at some point in your past with a niche, but now your audience is everybody. If you're Johnson & Johnson with AccuView lenses, you might have started with a small subset of humans that were early contact lens adopters, but now tons of people use contact lenses, and it's a huge variety of individuals.
I like to say that every brand is as strong as its weakest kind of touch point, the weakest thing that you put out there. So if you are a bigger company like a Folgers or Johnson & Johnson, there are a lot of people you could go after, especially Johnson & Johnson has so many different products. You still have to choose where you're going to do your marketing very well. And so if you're ever at a point where, be it resources or whatnot, where you're like, we're going to end up putting weak stuff out in the market, why even put it out? Because you're just going to potentially damage the perception that people have of you. So they need to pick and choose.
I mean, I totally agree. I look at a lot of the branding that's being done, especially by the large CPGs. I mean, I think what's the average tenure of a Fortune 500 CEO? It's less than a presidential term. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys are not sticking around that long. They're all short term in the way that they need wins on the board as quickly as possible. And a lot of these CPGs just haven't done the type of branding and type of marketing that keeps consumers loyal to them.
And I do think part of it is that the elements or the inspirers of loyalty have changed. Mm-hmm. That brands, what used to inspire loyalty was that kind of, I've seen your ad, you've made me aspire to be this person, and this person is through your brand, et cetera. Now it seems like more and more the loyalty, and you tell me if I'm just making stuff up here, but that there, the loyalty that people are building is actually, in some cases, to the influencers that represent the brand that the buyer connects with. That they may not be as much connecting with the brand, but they're connecting with the person that introduces and inspires the brand through this influencer community. And do you think that this influencer thing is about sort of building loyalty and creating a brand connection?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And what digital and social has done is made it much more prevalent and apparent in our face. It used to be going to high school and whatever the cool guy was wearing, that's what everyone else wanted to wear, right?
Definitely not me.
Yeah. or what you'd see in a fashion magazine. And I'm specifically talking about, like, you know, fashion and clothing and apparel and stuff like that. But the influencer has always been there. It's just how it's changed over time, and now how the influencer is pushing little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, now your influencer has a million friends.
Yeah, and they're a media person. They're a media site or person or persona, however you want to define it. They have an agenda if they're getting paid by a brand to promote stuff to you.
Yeah, and I was wondering how you're thinking of that trend going, because I see it more and more now.
Yeah, it's a pretty awesome topic to dig into, because, you know, like I was saying, there's always been influencers, right? And it used to be like the brand spokesperson who is paid, and they get up there and they're in a TV spot. And then, you know, earlier on in some iterations of my agency, we were doing, you know, tastemaker events, like having party promoters throw parties and we'd bring products in there. That was trying to get people to capitalize on, or we're capitalizing on that person's influence in a real setting. With digital channels, of course, now we're looking for people who have big followings to promote stuff. So I think there's definitely a world where it's gone too far, where it completely loses authenticity when it's so apparent that someone's being paid to promote something. However, it still works. If Kylie Jenner gets up and, you know, is paid $250,000 to promote something, it works. A lot of people see it and talk about it, and it's out there. I think people have to, one, make sure their brand is very aligned and make sure it feels authentic to them if they want to be one of those brands that separates themselves from the pack and has the right kind of allure and appeal, you know. So don't take a cheap route with influencers where you're literally just paying them to talk and it doesn't even feel right. They're just holding up a product and smiling and saying, hey, this product. If it's very authentic to them and the influencer believes in it and the content they create has a little more depth to it, I think that's kind of one of my biggest complaints now is just the photo of holding up the product. Like, come on, seriously, we can't think more creatively than that. Use it in your life. Like tell us something interesting about it that we can't see in the photo. You know, I think I would push an influencer to give us an experience or give us valuable information or inspire us in a way that we just can't see with our eyes. And then that truly provides the depth that makes you believe in the authenticity between that brand and that product and that person. So I think all too often I'm just seeing people have the base level of like, pay me and I'll take a photo and I'll put it up. I'd rather see people getting a lot more rich and deep with how they interact with influencers. I think that'll save it and make at least a segment of it better. But I think you're going to continue to see a broad range, very authentic pushing and promotion of products with very inauthentic kind of, you know, gotcha type influencer marketing.
Who does this well? Like who looks at the influencer space and uses the influencers to engage the community as opposed to just promote themselves?
Mm-hmm. When you're saying that, it made me think of two things. One is, Yeah, absolutely. Like the long term play with influencers. So it's not a one and done thing, building a relationship, because they've built a relationship with their audience. Their audience is in with them for the long haul. And so if it's a one and done partnership, you're not taking advantage of that. How can you build long term things? The second was, you know, the age old saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket. If you're launching a marketing program and you're saying the program is all influencers, you're absolutely right. Like, how does that actually benefit you beyond just the immediate exposure? So you have to have a way of looking at everything you're doing, whether it's part of a campaign or just your ongoing efforts, and say, this is just going to get us some cool content, some exposure, but what's the end game here? And, you know, whether it's getting people to subscribe to a podcast or an email list or become a customer and you can get the data from them that way, there's got to be a part of that matrix that is really looking at the influencer side of it for what it is, but still funnels people into something else where that benefits your business. So I think whatever the channel you're using to get exposure, it's kind of the same measurable result of how you then corral the customer from there.
Yeah, the way that you're thinking about this in terms of holistically connecting all the pieces into an overall branding and go-to-market strategy, I love and I completely agree with.
Influencer marketing can't be the end-all be-all. It has to be a way of getting people through to the next step. And also, the content that your brand is going to put out there, how much does that align with what the influencer is even saying? Because if you do get attention and you do get somebody to either follow you on social channels, subscribe to your email, purchase your product, does that even align with what they initially saw?
What's the worst misalignment you've ever seen?
Actually, some of the stuff that was most interesting to me was like these kind of twisted stories of different types of influencers, more so than maybe the product that was aligned with it. And so one of the topics I wanted to bring up was AI influencers. Are you guys familiar with that?
AI influencers?
Like not
like
real.
Like robots?
Digitally rendered people that have personas and names, and they're taking photos every day, and they're out there. And you know,
out where
they're on Instagram.
I think out there. I thought the most known one on the street.
Oh yeah, I hope not. The most known one is Lil Michaela. She has an Instagram following of 1.6 million followers, completely digitally rendered. It's not even
she doesn't exist.
She does not exist. But if you go there, it's completely digital rendered images. She's out with her AI friends doing all these cool things, and she's an influencer. I don't even know if I can say she. The character is an influencer. So that to me is like coming from wanting to be such a pure marketer and have everything be fully authentic. I like literally almost fell out of my seat when I first discovered that, like over a year ago. But that to me is like an example of wow, this has kind of gone a little too far when we're basically saying what this type of content means is real people authentically connecting and having such a valid and trusted voice, and then you throw a
artificial fake person
into there. Yeah, so not necessarily a fail in the sense of like a bad product aligned with a bad person. But
it seems to run counter to what the relationship is supposed to be. But, it's sort of Wizard of Oz-ish, right? Don't touch the curtain because who knows what's going on. But I would love to know, is there a brand behind that particular influencer? Or is it somebody who thought, well, I can't as a human being probably be an influencer, but boy, I can create this really cool persona that maybe people will connect.
Yeah, I mean, it's me. I'm not good looking enough to have been an influencer on my own, so I invented.
Oh, no. You have nowhere near the patience to, to be that committed to.
My understanding is it's the latter. It's not one brand behind it. It was somebody who probably wanted to do an experiment and had the means of designing, really, really very real looking images of people and came up with it.
I mean, hats off to that. I hear something like that, and I just think, I'm done. I quit.
This was what broke the camera.
Yeah, this
back
is what broke.
Oh man, there are a lot more straws in that line. I would love for you to describe to me my actually favorite example of that, which is a campaign that I saw on your website and it involved Dunkin' Donuts and the prom.
Oh, you're referring to the promposal boxes,
the
aren't
prom-posal.
You?
Promposal. Now, tell our audience what that was and how it came together and how it worked.
For those of you not familiar with what a promposal is, it's an extravagant way of proposing, that somebody go to the prom with you, but done in a way where you're kind of surprising and delighting them and then documenting it to kind of share the story via social channels. So it could be, you know, the thing that I compare it to is kind of gender reveals with babies, how people are going all out now and how they do that. Similar to that, you're coming up with some elaborate scheme of how you propose to someone go to the prom with you. So working with Dunkin' Donuts, you know, we collaborated with them to identify, well, people are actually using food boxes, whether it's a pizza box where you open up the lid and, you know, kind of says a message on there.
And pepperoni.
Or yeah, something. Yeah. If they want to go that far, yeah. And people, they notice we're using Dunkin' Donuts boxes. So buying a dozen donuts and writing a kind of donut pun in there or whatever. And so we collaborated with them to actually create these completely pimped out donut boxes. So we've done this for 2 years in a row. Most recently, we had like a disco theme, so we completely covered the box in you know, basically the reflectors that are on a disco ball. When you open up, there's a DJ table and flashing lights and two donuts sitting there as records and a whole message about going to the prom. And we did a whole online contest. You know, created a bunch of content, did a whole online contest to actually award these to 10 people to use for their proposal. And, you know, did a whole submission phase for people to kind of share stories to be able to win them and then sent them out. And then from there, people do it and they document it and they put up their own content about it.
You have to go to the site, gykantler.com and take a look at the box because it is stunning. When I saw it, I was like, oh my God, I wish I'd known that in high school because my proposal involved a little like sweaty rolled up piece of paper slid into a locker. We've gotten much better.
Oh, it's brands like Dunkin' Donuts that want to support people like you.
Pathetic souls who also love donuts. Yes. Luke, thank you so much for coming in and talking about this kind of new frontier and new way of thinking about connecting up with consumers and manufacturers, kind of building their own relationships, because I think it's really important to our audience, and we loved having you here.
Thanks for having me. Great time, guys.
Well, when I've started reflecting on my high school promposal as social commerce, we know it's time to move on. What are you thinking about your social commerce strategy? Have questions for Luke? Come to the Digital Shelf Institute's LinkedIn page or tweet at us at WinDigitalShelf. And drop a review of our podcast when you have a chance. We'd really appreciate it. And thanks for being part of our community.